Dr. Ralph Ford, Chancellor of Penn State Barron, and you are listening to Barron Talks. My guest today is Dr. Allison Rhodes. Allison is an Associate Professor of Engineering in our Plastics Engineering Technology program and the newly formed Polymer Engineering and Science program. Welcome here, Allison.
Thank you, Ralph.
Well, I'm going to take a moment and run through your biography, which is quite significant and substantial. You've done a lot, but I'll try to hit some of the high points. Maybe many people who are familiar with Barron know you've been here as a faculty member for a while. You are an alumna of Barron. You got a bachelor's degree in plastics engineering technology here. You hold a PhD in polymer science and engineering from the University of Southern Mississippi. Your research focuses on, and we're going to get into this and explain it for our audience, polymer thermodynamics, polymer crystallization, things like how do you formulate plastics for additive manufacturing. Earlier this month, and very significantly, you took on an important leadership role here at Barron, and you were named the Interim Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Studies. And what that means is you're going to be leading our research enterprise and the future of our graduate programs here, and we are grateful that you are doing that. One last thing. I will just add again, you're a highly accomplished teacher and researcher. You were awarded the NSF Career Grant and have developed a significant number of industry partnerships. So again, welcome here.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start. I wanted to talk a little bit about what brought you to Barron as a student and later as a faculty member. But let's just start out. Plastics. Why did you ever decide you wanted to get involved with plastics as a young person?
That's a great question. As a child, I was always mixing things, mixing slime, taking clay out of the creek bank and mixing it with melted pop rings at the campfire, just always mixing. And my dad is a petroleum engineer, also from Penn State, and I was quite inspired by the things he was doing at work. And I came to Penn State Barron actually to play softball specifically rather than University Park. And so while I was here, I wanted to be in engineering, but I didn't know which type, and the plastics engineering technology department absolutely looked like they were having the most fun. And so I really joined them because the faculty were engaging, the students were enjoying what they were doing, and the lab was awesome. Right. So that's what took me there.
It is a close-knit group, I will say that, and it remains that way today, and they do have an awful lot of fun. And you grew up in, I would say, you know, rural Pennsylvania as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, Tidewater, Pennsylvania, right on the Allegheny River. So
mixing things, working with silly putty, slime, all that stuff.
Yeah, I was very much a tomboy.
So as we know, Allison, plastics are in the news all the time. They're a big part of our lives. Why don't we start there and just tell us, why are plastics so important? Why are they so prevalent?
Well, it's best to take a look back into history and think about the challenges that humanity faced as a whole, say, prior to World War II. Think about what medical used to be. Think about what food storage used to be. Think about all the challenges that really limited even human life expectancy. And the onset of the use of plastics really became more commonplace after World War II, and that's because during the World Wars, metal became a scarcity, and resources to make typical household goods really became scarce. And so the government actually supported the first development of nylon 6/6 as a replacement for metal during World War II. After the war, those production facilities were in place and they started to make those same fibers but use them instead for ladies' stockings and, mm-hmm. and household goods. And then you see the onset of other types of plastics as the chemistry really became more understood. And so the field of polymers and plastics is actually not very old, you know, less than 120 years old, really. And so we're still in its infancy, but the impact on society has been so broad and so important. I particularly think about the way that it's changed food storage, and it's just remarkable how we can insulate our refrigerators and package our meat and all of the things that we take for granted now, but we don't do ice boxes and milk delivery anymore. And a lot of this has to do with the onset of the plastics industry. In addition, medical care is not what it used to be, and much of that is due to materials developments. And so I think those of us in the industry and those of us who are deep into the polymer science know that as awesome as it is now, from your computers, your hospitals, your cars, so many things, even your winter jackets, the speakers that are providing the sound to your ears, all of the things, it's still early in the game. And the future for plastics is even brighter than the past. So I hope that answers a bit.
Oh, no, that was a great answer. We could, you know, you and I could go on and on, but
yeah,
I'd like to
chat all day.
Dig into a few of these. What's amazing to me is, you know, something so simple that we see in the grocery store every day, that plastic wrap that goes around meat and everything else, it's actually fairly high tech, and there's a lot of design that goes into the different layers that are there. It's not just like a simple piece of plastic. It's engineered to make that last longer, which of course provides a lot of benefit.
Right. Yeah. So probably the polymer scientists out there are a humble bunch, and they don't really promote how much work and thought goes into designing multi-laminated films. But you can think about oxygen. They don't want oxygen to go in, but moisture sometimes needs to pass. So selective barriers, temperature controlled, diffusion, all types of things go into packaging. And yeah, the science behind that is fascinating. But the science is only one part. You can make something on a lab bench. That's great. But scaling it up so that it has an impact on society and becomes a commercial venture is something completely different. And that's where manufacturing comes into play. And I think that's one of our strengths here at Behrend, is connecting really good science with the reality of manufacturing and saying, how do we take something that's important and we know it's going to be important, and how do we bring that to market? How do we work with companies to do that, especially in the plastics space?
And, you know, that leads us into further experiences in your career, and you came back here. But before we get to that, you know, when you were an undergraduate, so let's go back when you were here and you were playing softball. And did you have any idea what you wanted to do after you graduated? What did you think you wanted to do? Can you remember back?
Well, I certainly did not think I wanted to be a professor. So that was a change in plans for me. At the time, I very much loved industry, and the plastics department did a great job of giving us opportunities for internships and co-ops. So I had a lot of industrial interaction as a student. That drove me actually to go to graduate school, because I worked with some excellent professionals when I was an undergraduate, and I saw what they were able to do and what they were able to think through in terms of material science, and I wanted to be able to do that. So I went to graduate school pursuing a PhD, and at that point I thought, man, it's possible I get a PhD only so I can work part-time so that I can have a family and still, you know, provide some income. So I left a lot of it really open in terms of what opportunities would come and what would fit, you know, where the future was going. But I was never too worried about it, I'll put it that way.
Well, you took a little bit of an unusual step, not completely, but you got your PhD, and then you went to industry and you worked for Behrend Materials Science. You worked for something, an organization called the Nanomaterials Commercialization Center in Pittsburgh. So how did that influence your thinking, your teaching, your research that you do now?
Heavily, heavily influenced both my role as a professor and what I hope to do in the position of interim associate dean for research. My first professional role was at the Nanomaterials Commercialization Center. This was a jointly funded state and government Air Force initiative to take nanotechnologies, this was the early 2000s, and bring them to the market. And again, it's the same challenges. You have some material science, but you don't have the scale up in the manufacturing. And so my job was to help identify those technologies and then partner small companies, inventors, really creative and fantastic people, but they needed structure and they needed a path. So we would connect them with university partners and with large companies that were willing to do the pull through. And through that, I learned a lot about commercialization, which was also a minor for me in graduate school. So I have always had a foot in the commercialization boat. And it really does take a monstrous effort to take a new technology, a nascent science basic concept, and move that into a product line that makes a difference. So that's what I learned there. And I was there about 18 months, and then the people from Behrend Materials Science were big supporters of the Nano Center, and Bob Kumpf, who was on the board, suggested that I move over to Behrend Materials Science, which is now Covestro in Pittsburgh. So that's how I got to Covestro. At Covestro, Behrend Materials Science, Bayer, the German Bayer, that is just a bastion of excellent scientists. And so it was extremely motivating to see all of the things that they could do. I feel like I was not the smartest person in the room ever. There are some wonderful and very talented people there. And again, I learned about sustainability there. That was my first exposure to life cycle analysis, because we were looking to take bio-based monomers and move these into polymer, commercial polymers. And this was kind of novel at the time, about 2010. So that was a great experience, all very much shaped the way that I think about the polymer industry. It's not a disposable industry. It's not a short-term commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all of that thinking came with me here to Behrend.
Yeah, Bayer / Covestro, as they're called now, they remain a really good partner with us. We send a lot of students there.
Yep.
We're going to come back. They're a big leader in sustainable materials right now and trying to lead the way. But let's go back to the question of, so you were there, and what brought you back to academia then?
Well, Penn State Behrend faculty had a great practice of staying in touch with their students. So John Beaumont, John Meckley, Paul Cook, many faculty members that I had as a student kept tabs, kept up communication, had great relationships with me moving forward. And when an opening came up in the department, they called. So that is one thing. I was not expecting the call, but they were looking for someone that had industrial experience and a PhD that also had a passion for the department. And I absolutely had a passion for the department. I believe the plastics department here is important. It puts the right kind of people in the industry to make the right kind of decisions and move the needle. So they called, and at the time my job was really ramping up at Covestro. It was getting very challenging with travel, balancing family, everything mm-hmm. else. So the idea of coming back to Behrend, a little bit of independence in building programs that I believed in, keeping the next generation plugged in with what I believed were important goals for our industry, it was all just too enticing to say no.
All the pieces fit.
Yep.
And, you know, I was part of that discussion
yes,
as well.
You were.
I was director of the engineering school, but it was John Beaumont and the faculty members really advocated and
yeah.
brought you back. And it's
yeah,
I think
they're
it's been
great
a great career path for you. So
great people.
Well, the one of the things that happened shortly after you got here was you applied for and received something known as an NSF, and that's National Science Foundation, for our listeners, career grant. And it's significant, I know that, but why don't you explain to us what the significance of that grant is and how did it help you launch your career here?
So the National Science Foundation's Career Award Program is designed to identify high potential faculty talent in early in their career so that they don't get stymied in the age-old problem of bringing in enough money to do what they need to do,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I didn't apply for my career grant until my fourth year as a professor, or maybe my third year, I can't remember now. But anyways, the last year I was able to apply, because you have to be early career. And I only gave it one shot, but at that point my industry background and my exposure to the world of polymer science had really crystallized, and I was able to identify a sweet spot, right? The plastics industry is strong and thriving and moving forward. The polymer science world, the world of polymer science, is in itself a thriving community of really brilliant people, and they almost never talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
The plastics industry and the polymer scientists almost never talk. And so basically I proposed a program that would bring the best of polymer science to bear fruit in plastics manufacturing. And it really resonated with NSF, and they funded it basically immediately. I also had several industrial support letters and partners and academic partners. We rallied quite a bit of excitement around it. So I'm definitely thankful for that award. It allowed us to build a core competency group here at Behrend that at this point is really the best in the nation, arguably one of the best in the world for what we do. And I'm really happy about that.
Well, I think it's word that we need to get out further is we've got a really significant research group up and running here. You've attracted some of the best minds in the country, and kudos to you and the whole team. So let's take this a little deeper. You work in the area of polymer thermodynamics and crystallization.
Yep.
And you look at temperature changes and really high rates of speed. Okay. What does that mean and why is that important?
Yeah, who cares, right? So I think, again, you have to go back to manufacturing. So think about plastics manufacturing. A lot of people in our region, plastics industry is wildly important here. And everybody knows somebody that works in a molding shop, right? So in plastics molding, what happens is you heat up the plastic, you melt it like candle wax when it's melted, and then they smash it into a mold at a high speed, and the mold is cold and metal. And so the plastic, just like wax, pouring it onto a countertop, it solidifies really quickly, okay? But in reality, the speed at which many, many polymers solidify, not all of them, but many important ones, especially nylons, polyethylene, high-density polyethylene, polypropylene, things you've heard from the recycling bin land, right? Those polymers, if they cool too quickly or too slowly, or if they have been under a lot of stress by being moved really rapidly and then they cool really quickly, they don't solidify properly. And when I say properly, what I mean is they actually need a little bit of time to form what is known as a crystalline structure in polymers. Now, crystal structures are funny things. You can think about crystals of or different molecular arrangements of something like carbon, right? You can make a diamond or you can make a pencil lead. It depends, you know, how you organize these things. And in polymers, it's really no different. It's just something that people haven't really tried to control over the years. And as it turns out, as our applications in society push the boundaries of what plastics can do, nobody wants to have a bearing that cracks in half. Nobody even wants a plastic fork that breaks in two pieces in their mouth when they take a bite of their salad. You have to control the way that the polymer organizes itself as it solidifies in order to maximize the way that that polymer will perform. And that's what my group has developed the expertise in, experiments, but also modeling. So how do you take the information about the way that plastic is setting up and move that into a model that can be used to design a manufacturing process that's totally optimized?
And you have industry partners involved with this work. So this is truly going out into the field.
Very much. Yeah. So our group has sponsors that are materials companies. So Invista, for example, they hold the patents for all of the nylon 6/6 production. Nylon 6/6 is very important to all of you, even if you don't know it. You know, we have interest from Dow. We have strong project from the other end of the spectrum, SKF Corporation, who has trusted us now for about 8 years with developing material systems, processing, and modeling for their bearings, for bearings in aerospace. So, you know, when you really are pushing the performance of a plastic, you have to do it right. And that's what we help them to do. Wow.
And you've also taken on a role in the last several years as director of something known as the AREC Center, AREC, known as the Advanced Resource Efficiency Center. Yep. It's a partnership between us and the University of Sheffield and some others around the world and here in Pennsylvania. Tell us, what's that center about? What do you do?
So the Advanced Resource Efficiency Center is a group of faculty with industry partners, really, who have deep talent in life cycle analysis, life cycle costing, and techno-economic analysis. And you might say, does that mean I have such experience? I'm not an expert in life cycle analysis, but especially from my days at Covestro, I know how important it is. Because in our current society, it's not just dollars and cents that matter, right? So companies are becoming under increasing pressure from society to care about the environment, to care about the planet. Like, are we harming our future selves, our children, our grandchildren, with the way that we are living a disposable lifestyle? You know, and in some parts, it is, you know, if you're only measuring economics and you have a very narrow view and you're only pushing for pennies on manufacturing, maybe that's the way that it used to be acceptable, but it's no longer, that's no longer acceptable, right? And so we have this new pressure from society, new as in 5 years, especially pre-COVID, the plastics industry was absolutely under the gun, right? We were in the bullseye for being the bad guys with the environment. And a little bit before that, we started to think about the way that our regional industries needed to be aware of the decisions they were making and the implications for environmental carbon footprint, the way that the waste was being handled, all sorts of things. So we developed a partnership with the Eric Center at the University of Sheffield. And there they have deep expertise also in life cycle analysis. And the thing we like the most about them is they looked at the entire supply chain. So you can do life cycle analysis on the production of one little item in your, like, of polyethylene. We can do a life cycle analysis of polyethylene. But if you don't broaden the vision and look at the entire supply chain, then you may be sort of saving a little bit of energy efficiency over here, but losing all of your benefit in the bigger picture. What do I mean by that? Let me think how I can explain this.
I think I can help you with this one.
Yeah, help me.
I think there are just a lot of products out there. We make assumptions about them. So you take a plastic water bottle. I'll give you a couple other examples. So and if I compare that to, say, using an aluminum container or using a glass container, and I really want to understand the full life cycle, I need to know how much energy goes into it. And this really impacts greenhouse gases. And I think a lot of people, if you do a real complete analysis of it, and you know, I stay up some nights trying to at least understand some of the literature on this because it just interests me, you come to some surprising conclusions.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you for the prompt. So in any product, you have competitive products, right? So for the water bottle example that Ralph made, or you can think about the plastic bag example, right? Mm-hmm. It seems out of the gate as if the paper bag is by nature. It's sustainable, right? It's made from wood pulp. And that just must be better than dragging oil out of the ground and making a plastic bottle. But if you are absolutely concerned with the embodied energy and the carbon footprint of the thing and the big picture of the impact of that product, how much water did it take to make the paper bag? How much heat did it take to make the plastic bottle? How do you balance and compare two processes that are actually by nature quite different and look at them for what should be measured, right? Embodied energy, the long-term lifetime of the product, where does it go when it's done being used, that type of thing. You're often surprised. Our gut reactions that are sometimes driven even by media and memes, and they seem to make sense at a first blush, those are actually not always the best decisions to make if you really care about the environmental impact of the products. Now, that's not to say that plastics don't have problems with waste disposal, especially. You know, I think we all saw that when China stopped taking our recycling, mm-hmm. right? That was a big wake-up call to us. But the answer is not a quick switch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, humans in general are not always that good at making decisions sometimes as good as we think we are, and this is just another domain. But to your point, you just have to carefully analyze. Plastics may be the right answer. They may not.
They may not be, right.
And I think as we go forward with solar panels and changes to electric vehicles, and I'm not arguing against that, but there are other impacts on rare earth minerals and
right.
there, you know, that have to be thought through.
Yes.
It is the way that we are going, and for a good reason.
Yes.
But people don't always understand the complexity of what's really going into those products.
Correct, and that's really where the Eric Center comes into play. So we have already a nice track record of helping companies look at an opportunity, even for new product adoption, new manufacturing line adoption, change in product line, response to customer demand, where a customer might say, you have to do 50% recycled by the end of next year, or else, well, why? What are you trying to do? What needle are you trying to move? Mm-hmm. And will this change actually move that needle? Because if switching to 50% recycled requires that recycled material be shipped on a barge from China back to the United States so that you can use it, mm-hmm. that very well may negate any positive, you know, displacement from not using virgin material in the first place. So you really have to look at the big picture, and this is what we do through the Eric Center. I can't take any credit for the real analyses. These are the talents of Gamini Mendes, Chris Costello, Rhee Shi at University Park. We have some awesome faculty that are wrapped up in the Eric Center. They have different technical backgrounds. So we have some expertise in polymers. We have some expertise in chemical engineering. We have expertise in agriculture and food waste, because all of it goes to the same landfill, right? Yeah. All of these things come from a carbon source. So the different faculty, the different industries overlap much more than you might expect.
So let's take it back to our students. So a student who's thinking about coming to Barron and studying plastics and polymers, can they get involved in this?
Very much so. We have now faculty that specialize in this in our polymer plastics departments, right? Gamini Mendis especially. And this is a new area for us in terms of specialty. What we can do with the students is set the paradigm. We can set the expectation for them that as polymer engineers, polymer scientists, whatever they aim to be, they have a responsibility to do this right. And they have a responsibility to think hard and deep about the real challenges and make sure that their decisions are having the impact that we all hope they do, right? So we do that through, we have a sustainability, polymer sustainability class now that's taught. Some of that curriculum looks at, for example, how do polymers degrade? You probably think that you throw this bottle in the woods and it's there 4 million years later. You know, in reality, the degradation mechanisms can be much quicker. And if you want to make them even faster, you can do that. You know, so polymer design, processing aids that will allow polymers to break down much faster, new strategies for recycling, proper waste handling and management, sorting technologies. Mm-hmm. How do you, you know, what do you do with a blue bin of recycled materials that's all mixed up? The energy that goes to sorting them goes towards the bottom line of energy for the system. So all of these aspects, you know, the students are now exposed to, and it's our expectation that we are training next generation polymer engineers, plastics engineers that have a really, you know, strong skill set in that area.
Well, extremely well said. Let me switch gears a little bit. In terms of your personal career, one of the things I noticed in your bio was that you were involved in something known as the Women in America program. You were a Women in America mentee. It looks like the number of Fortune 500 companies were involved in this. So what was that? What was that?
That was quite an experience. Yeah, that was it started when I was in graduate school. I think I was heavily involved for about 4 years, and it was a group of Fortune 500 women. So Forbes' most powerful women list. Mm-hmm. They came together. And they said, we want to mentor the next generation of professional women. And to their credit, they included STEM women, so women trained in technology. And that's how I was chosen to be a part of that initial group. So I was in the inaugural class.
Wow.
And so, you know, the CEO of Xerox was involved. We had American Express. It was an incredible group of women, absolutely incredible. And quarterly, we would go, and we were trained in things like public speaking, liability, legal analysis, career planning, everything you could imagine. And it was a very big challenge because I really thought I kind of had it together from a professional point of view. And every time I went there, I was just shocked how much better these women were at this than me. But
there's always somebody smarter.
There's always someone smarter. There's always someone more elegant. You know, it was great. And it was a time that helped me hone what I wanted to do and what I didn't, because I was able to see all these different career paths, and every session was held in Manhattan, JP Morgan, all these places. So it made me comfortable in that space, and it made me comfortable coming back to Erie, because, you know, you're not always striving for something that's more glamorous. You learn where you love and where you want to be, and then you bring your training home with you. And so I'm thankful for that experience. I think it absolutely helped to hone my professional skills. And I'm still amazed that those women took the time to do that. And that group is still going.
Wow.
Yep.
And you've carried that work on while you're here. And Barron has a very large outreach presence. We interact with a lot of children in the K-12 space, but you've been particularly involved in the Women in Engineering program, I believe.
Well, I mean, women in engineering is something near and dear to my heart. When I was in my undergraduate class, we had 62 people in the class, and I think there were 4 women, and the 4 of us had to make a little band. It's maybe a little different now. The numbers are a little better in engineering now.
They are.
But yeah, but I think that there's some challenges just because some of the expectations in the industry was really built around men and men's way of working, and women just have a slightly different way of working. And it's okay to say that we are slightly different, and being able to support women as they're up against challenges and be a listening ear, number one, but also a promoter and an encourager, because you cannot build a career on being a woman alone. You have to put, the rubber has to meet the road. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I try to bring to them. And I try to get them fired up. We try to do a lot of awesome examples. We try to really paint career paths, spend a lot of time connecting undergraduate women with professionals in the field, because there's no substitute for talking to someone that's in the role that you're imagining yourself in someday. And so I think that's important.
Well, we are coming to the end of our time, so I will give you the last words. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Allison?
Well, thanks for the time. I really appreciate it. It's nice. And I think in closing, I would mention that our region here in Erie, we have been gifted, really blessed with a strong plastics industry via legacy, right? None of us started it. And we have a Great Lake sitting right here, and none of us dug that hole and filled it with water. And so taking care of the resources that we have and that we've been given is something that I think as our college can really play a big role in that. And we need to own that. And so we are always looking for people who are fired up about building support around our core competencies in the region. And if anybody has ideas or anybody would like to discuss that further, I would encourage them to give us a call. For more information, please just check out the Penn State Barron website, and you can also Google the Arec Center, AREC, at Barron.
Just reach out.
Just reach out. Yep, we're here.
All right, well said. Well, you have been listening to Barron Talks. I'm Chancellor Ralph Ford. My guest today is Dr. Allison Rhodes, our incoming Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Studies. It's been a fabulous conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.